p.m. This is Radio Ghana.
A very good evening to you, and you're welcome to Behind the News, our news and current affairs program which examines issues from the perspective of newsmakers and experts. My name is Agatha Samwine. Tonight, collapse of six-story Melcom store at Achimota. Could it have been avoided? President Mahama says those responsible will pay a price. Vice presidential candidate of four parties with representation in parliament have stated their case in a debate in Takoradi. Were they able to carry their messages across to convince floating voters? And Americans give verdict as to who occupies the White House for the next 4 years. Stay with me in the next hour as we delve into these issues. But before we go into them, George Asekeze with a summary of the day's news.
President John Mahama has warned that anyone found culpable of negligence leading to the collapse of the six-story Melcom building at Achimota will be prosecuted. He described the incident as a national disaster and announced that government will set up a committee to investigate the disaster. President Mahama later visited victims of the incident admitted in hospitals, including the Achimota and the 37 military hospital. Meanwhile, 40 people have so far been rescued, with four officially pronounced dead. The Public Relations Office of the Ghana National Fire Service, Billy Anaglati, confirmed this to Radio Ghana. The presidential candidate of the NPP, Nana Dankwa Akufo-Addo, has suspended his campaign to the Ashanti region to visit the Melcom site where the building collapsed. He expressed deep condolences to the families of the victims and commended the security agencies for responding swiftly to the disaster. And government has congratulated the people of America on their successful election, which retained President Barack Obama. Vice President Park Kwesi-Emisa Arthur, in a congratulatory message, said free, fair and transparent election that has taken place in the U.S. is ample testimony that democracy is the way to go.
It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana, Kari, also live on Unique FM 95.7, Obonu FM 96.5 in Tema, and in Cape Coast is on Radio Central 92.5. Tragedy hit Achimota, a suburb of Accra, when a six-story building belonging to the retail giant Melcom came tumbling down this morning. Latest reports say four people are feared dead, while several others remain trapped in the rubble. Rescue teams made up of the police, fire service, NADMO, the military, the National Ambulance Service, as well as public volunteers have been working around the clock to rescue those still trapped in the rubble. In Ghana, hardly do we hear of disasters or the magnitude of the collapsed building. In places like Japan and Turkey, when one sees such disasters and victims trying to free themselves from rubble, the cause may probably be an act of God, like an earthquake. In Iraq and Lebanon, as well as other volatile areas, suicide bombers have brought buildings to the ground by their actions. But when it happens in Ghana, what should we attribute the cause to? Let's go to the disaster grounds and seek some answers from DSP Freeman Pite, Accra Regional Police PRO, who has joined us on the telephone. You're welcome, DSP Tete.
Good evening, my sister.
Well, you have been on the ground since the morning. Have you picked up signals as to the cause of the disaster?
It will be difficult and it's premature for us to come out to the cause, because this will be investigated by the appropriate agencies.
But for now, can you also tell us how many are dead?
It is on record that we have one dead, and then so far 54 has been rescued by the operation team.
And the injured, how many, and we understand they have been distributed to hospitals around the capital. Can you tell us which specific hospitals they have been sent to?
They've been sent to 37 military hospitals, the Kolebu Teaching Hospital, the police hospital, as well as Achimota Hospital. So this is, they are actually receiving treatment, and we've been told that most of them are responding to treatment.
But how many of them are injured as we speak?
I think it's almost everybody that has been rescued has sustained some form of injury, be it minor or major injury. So that is what we can say, because we cannot go into details as to the number that have sustained serious injuries, because it is unnecessary. There could be an internal bleeding as well. So these are the things that the medics are looking at.
Also, we saw a lot of people at the scene, but how have they made your work difficult?
Initially, it was really difficult, but we were able to persuade them, and so when the need for us to apply some kind of force, we have to do that. So at the end of the day, we were able to restrain most of them. We called on the place. It actually happened before we got there, which is obvious. So they were actually there before we got there. So managing the crowd became a problem, but we have to apply expertise with the support of the men on the ground. We were able to ward them off for the rescue team to go about its work without interference.
Can you also tell us whether there have been any looting?
No, there hasn't been any looting, because the nature of the collapse did not expose any property or any material that is in stock, because everything actually crumbled from the top to the down, so nothing has been exposed. And beside that, there was massive security build up there, which will never under any circumstance encourage looting.
Alright, we are very grateful for your time with us tonight.
Thank you.
DSP Freeman Tete is Accra Regional Police PRO. Our text line is 0240971087. Our text line again is 0240971087. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana Accra. Now, the Ghana National Fire Service has also been complimenting the efforts of the rescue teams to bring the trapped out. Deputy PRO of the service, Billy Anaglate, also joins us live on the telephone. You are welcome, Mr. Anaglate.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, how difficult has it been for your men to rescue victims of the disaster?
Well, actually, it was difficult. When our first firefighting engine and the rescue men got to the scene, we realized that there were a lot of people, the public were there, they were trying to see how they themselves will be able to rescue the people before our men got them. And that because of fashion and the way they look at the whole thing, and it's like they were trying to interfere into our operational duty. And then what we did was to call in the police to ensure that sanity was put in place to enable us work. But it got to a time we realized that they themselves have realized that this type of work should be left for the technical men to do, and they have really left it for us to do. That is what we've been doing since morning up to this time.
Well, can you confirm to us the number of people who have died?
So far, we have rescued 45 people, and it was only one of them that was reported dead.
45 people rescued, but only one dead.
Yes, exactly.
Well, so what technical advice would you give to people who put up such high-rise buildings, particularly on fire safety measures?
Yeah, exactly. Our LI 1724 have stipulated it clearly that before any type of these premises are put up, the permit must be submitted to the Ghana National Fire Service, where we will be able to assess it and make an input. The input will be looking at the occupancy level of the premises, that is how many people will be within that premises at a go, and then looking at it as against the number of exits that will be constructed, and other safety measures that will also be put in place. That is why we have our rep at the town and country technical committee, that before a permit is given to you, you submit your plan to the town and country technical committee, that the fire service rep will be able to look at it and make an input to it. So what we want to do is that if really we want to avert some of these unfortunate situations, then we should ensure that these plans are submitted to down country planning or personally to the Ghana National Fire Service, where we will look at it and make an input. The input that we do attempt cut across at the time that we even sometimes have to prescribe the type of material that should be used in constructing some of these buildings. So it is in our own interest to submit these building plans to the fire service. So we should all try and adhere to our airline 1724 for us to prevent this unfortunate situation.
But would you be in a position to tell us if the collapsed building satisfied all the fire safety equipment?
That would be difficult for me to tell for now, because I know we have our safety department that actually respects some of these safety requirements. For now, since I've not been able to find out from any one of them to know if really they have satisfied these safety requirements, it's going to be part of our investigation that we'll be doing to find out if really it has satisfied the safety requirements. So for now, I'll not be able to tell whether they have or not.
Well, I will also ask you this, because we saw a lot of people at the scene. How have they made your work difficult?
Yeah, like I said earlier on, that even assessing and working with the tool becomes a problem, because we see other civilians and other people trying even to wrestle the equipment with you, just because they think that it is just a matter of coming to use equipment to push off the slabs and other things. Forgetting that rescue exercise, as a matter of fact, where buildings, slabs have collapsed on each other from the very top to the last floor, you need to be very technical and then be able to ensure that your actions do not rather compress the burden on the people that are already suppressed under it. You need to technically and then remove each slab one after the other to ensure that the person is rescued. But they are going in, they think that we need to use just force to push off those slabs and to get to the bottom of it. And here is again that they are not equipped, they were not in helmet, they were not in any personal protective equipment. So you are working as an operational man to rescue somebody, and yet those other people that are not properly protected, you are also trying to protect them as well. So the work was really difficult at the initial stage. But when they themselves realized that it is beyond their skill and knowledge, they have relegated the job to us, and that is all we've been doing as of now.
Well, Mr. Anaglete, I'll go back to the number of people confirmed dead, because in such a disaster, casualty figures are very critical. But how come that some media houses have been given different casualty figures, especially to those who lost their lives? Some are saying three, others put the figures at four.
I'm surprised that people are pegging the figures of the dead to three or four, because we are on the ground. I am saying that the person that have been reported there was just a single person, a woman, that was reported dead. The rest of the people were all kicking, although some of them were seriously injured before sent to hospital, but they were in a condition that nobody would be thinking that they would die. I'm surprised to hear that people mention that about three or four people died. When the situation happened of this nature, there are a lot of people that exaggerate. I have been on the ground from morning up to this time. And if any one of those people sent to hospital died thereafter, I don't have knowledge of it. But I'm telling you exactly what I have known on the ground since I've been on the ground from morning up to this time. So when I even talked to the owners of the premises, just I think about an hour ago about the condition of the people at the hospital, they have also not mentioned that there was any other death reported. So I will not be able to tell where the people have seen people, other dead bodies, and they are confirming about three or four people have died out of it. But what I know is that only one person, and I saw one person that was reported dead, and the rest of the people we rescued with various categories of injury, that I could see. But I've not heard any one of them dying thereafter that he or she was sent to hospital.
All right, we are very grateful for your time with us tonight.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Deputy PRO of the Ghana National Fire Service, Billy Anaglete. Now let's pick the thoughts of our expert on buildings, and Engineer Magnus Kwashi is the Vice President of the Ghana Institution of Engineers, and he's on the line. You're welcome, Mr. Kwashi.
Many thanks.
I'm sure you have been monitoring news about this collapse Melcom edifice at Achimota. What, in your technical expertise, do you think might have been the cause?
Well, I must say that at the moment we may make conjectures. You know, but usually when these things fail, we may look at probably whether there were any environmental factors. We haven't heard that there was an earthquake, so that may be ruled out. So we may be looking primarily at structural failure, okay, which may arise due to maybe poor foundation design, and then also poor workmanship, because we can have a very well designed building. However, if the material that were prescribed for construction were not adhered to, that can also create some of these disasters as we see. But I must say that we have been requested verbally by the chairman of the Parliamentary Select Committee on Water Resources, Works and Housing, and also the Deputy Minister for Works and Water Resources, Works and Housing, to quickly constitute a team to investigate what might actually have caused the collapse of the building. And we have done that, and quickly tomorrow morning our team will be on site to assess the situation.
Well, but some laymen have been attributing the collapse to a weak foundation or inadequate cement in the structure. Is that also a possibility?
Well, these are all possibilities. You see, and sometimes I was there this evening, and if you look at the way, usually you wouldn't expect a reinforced concrete structure just to drop this way, you know, in one go for such a huge building. If even there was earthquake or anything, I can be sure that portions of it will collapse and then the earth will come down gradually. However, those came down in one go, and even people are using some of these reasons that you could find the way some of the concrete portions are crumbled and so on and so forth. But we cannot rule that out. If the right reinforcement, you know, was not introduced into the structure, and also if the right concrete mixes were not done, certainly this could lead to some point there, you know, and due to workmanship.
Well, Mr. Kwashi, when in your estimation and can the rescue team rescue all the people trapped there?
Say that again. What in my estimation?
Yeah, can the rescue team, can they rescue all the people trapped in there?
Well, I must really commend the rescue team because as far as I'm concerned, we do not even have the requisite equipment. You know, I don't think we are really prepared for some of these things, because we need things like jaw breakers and so on and so forth. I mean, I was at the site this afternoon around 7 to 2, and then I saw one small one crawling to the site. So I must really commend them for, from various stations that they've been able to redeem nearly 51 or so. I mean, if the figure is right. And I must really commend the fire service, the police, for a great job done. Because we don't have the requisite equipment. I mean, I was on the site, some of them have no helmets. You know, we don't have breakers and so on and so forth. So in terms of the lack of equipment and so on and so forth, I must say that they've done pretty well. Otherwise, it should have taken a day. I understand there are about 2 or more people trapped in. If we know exactly how many people were there, I'm told about 56 or 53 or so. And I know they are still there. And hopefully we can get these other people out. But honestly, I must say that the rescue team have done a great job.
But has the Institution of Engineers visited the site of the collapse?
Yes, I did mention that I was on the site on behalf of the Ghana Institution of Engineers this afternoon, where I met the Deputy Minister for the Water Resources, Works and Housing, and also David Osimi, the Honorable Chairman for the Parliamentary Select Committee on Works and Housing. So I was there on the site personally. I met with them, and they have verbally requested that the Institution of Engineers constitute quickly a team to investigate the reason for the failure or the collapse of the building. We have done that, and tomorrow morning our team will be at the site with some equipment to actually test also the strength of the concrete on portions of the building, and actually investigate why the building failed, which will present to the select committee and also to the Ministry of Resources, Water Resources, Works and Housing.
Well, but in your opinion, what could be done to stave off such disasters in future?
Now, I tell you, we have in place the necessary structures, you know, to forestall all of these things. But as a people and as a country, I think that we need the resolve to do the right thing. You know, the law says that we have a building regulation that says that if you want to construct a building, you need to get your documentation done, which means that you must have hired an engineer, an architect, an engineer, and so on and so on, to put together all your documentation, which means the design would have been properly done and certified by an engineer who is properly registered, you know, with the Ghana Institution of Engineers, which means that he is able to give proper judgment to whatever he's doing. Now, when all of these things are done, you will submit it to the assembly. Now, the assembly usually will check that your structural design is done, and so they ask all of these things at the assembly. But I must say that, you see, our assemblies are grossly understaffed. They are grossly understaffed. And even where they are staffing, they need a lot of training and equipment to be able to do that. So that is one thing. Even when they have done all of these things, you get a building permit. Now, when you get a building permit, you even need to notify the assembly by the regulation that you are going to start the building. Then they will appoint a building inspector. Now, what the building inspector does is that at every stage, they are very key of your project. They are keystone. They will have to come and inspect before you do certain things. Now, even when you finish putting up a building, you need what we call a habitation permit. And so you need to notify once there's a building inspector, the city will know that your building is completed, and then they will inspect it, including the wiring and so on and so forth. Then you receive what we call a habitation permit. Now, when you receive the habitation permit, then the city has certified that this building is habitable. You know, because every building, even an individual house. It's necessary because we cannot say that it's a private house. Once you can get visited, it means that the public must be of interest in whatever structure that is being put up. Now, this is the procedure. But our systems have broken down, systems have failed, you know, people are doing back door and so on and so forth. People start their buildings and we have to write software and so on and so forth. We don't have enough people to go on the field to do that. We don't have the willpower and the political will to do the right to remove and to stop buildings and so on and so forth. People start talking about what we call human rights and when they are doing the wrong thing. You see, and as a country, we need a result. Now, interestingly and happy enough, for so many years, only last year, the late president of Amir actually assented or signed what we call the engineering registering council. So, as I speak now, there's an engineering law that must check who does what. You know, so anybody who does anything engineering will be all being categorized in the law. They have to be properly registered.
But
we are certain who is doing what at every point in time.
But, Mr. Kwasi, in the light of all this, can you tell us if your institution is involved in the construction of sky-high buildings like that of Melcom in the country?
Now, if you talk about our institution, the general institution now, what happens is that under the NRCD Law 143, we are mandated to register and keep a register of all those who practice engineering. Now, some people have not registered. They are hired by people, and so occasionally there are people who are practicing engineering in this country who are not properly registered. I cannot say for certain now until we do the investigation to be able to determine who did the structural design of the building, whether they did what we call a geotechnical survey to actually find out the soil structure, you know, before the foundation was designed. So our investigation will tell us whether somebody properly registered with the institution was involved in this. In much the same way, the architects are doing the same. We'll check who was the architect behind this and so on and so forth. Now, so that's one step. The other issue is that even a building can be properly designed, but as to whether it receives the right workmanship and craftsmanship is also an issue, because a lot of buildings are going on between the owner of the property and foremen and masons. You see, so you find that when it gets to construction sometimes, you may find that there's no engineer involved checking this, or giving any quality assurance or quality control.
All right.
So once we start to do this, we will try to establish what has happened. But I think that it's a wake-up call for all of us engineers, for individuals who have projects. You see, to employ the right kind of people, you know, to help them do the right thing.
All right, but briefly before I let you go, would you recommend that some people be held responsible for this?
Oh, why not? Certainly, you see, I think that we can only move forward as a country when we take time to find out what things have happened, who must have done what and didn't do, and so on and so forth. You see, and then we correct them. We can't just pass the buck that it's okay. This is not the first time a building has collapsed. And I think if we did the right thing, if we made sure that people involved were actually punished appropriately, I believe that we would have moved forward.
Right.
So the last few years, buildings have collapsed in Accra, in Kumasi, and so on. And it continues. And I think this should teach us a lesson. And we need to find out who should have done what and didn't do, and so on and so forth. You see, and then we should be able to hire and fire so that people in responsible positions,
all right,
will be serious what they do, because this is costing lives.
All right. It's been a pleasure having you on our program. Engineer Magnus Kwashi is the Vice President of the Ghana Institution of Engineers, and the country's disaster management organization, NADMO, was also in the thick of affairs. The Deputy National Coordinator in charge of Technical Affairs, Ebenezer Dosos, who joins us on the phone. You are welcome, Eben.
Thank you, Agatha.
Well, what has NADMO done so far for those who survived this fatal accident?
We've, in collaboration with our partners as usual, NADMO doesn't work alone. We work with the National Ambulance, we work with the military, 48 engineers, we work with the police, we work with fire service, we work with the hospital, and a whole lot of other institutions. And so, as they were taken out of the rubble, rescued from the rubble, we made sure that the Ghana National Ambulance Service is right there. So they were carrying them to the hospital, four major hospitals. We sent those people to 37 Military Hospital, Kolebu Teaching Hospital, Achimota Hospital, and the Police Hospital. And what we have done for them is to make sure that the hospital people take care of them. I mean, once they get there, they know what to do. And we've sent people around the hospitals to make sure that we have the figures right with those on site. And so for 37 military hospitals, there are 16 people on admission now. And then for they have five, they treated five and discharged them. So you have 21 having been taken to 37 military hospital. Kolebu Teaching Hospital, they were sent three people, two on admission, one was treated and discharged. Achimota Hospital, 29, 10 are on admission, 18 have been treated and discharged, and one has been referred to Kolebu because she had some neck or head injury that affected the neck. Then police hospital, three have been sent there and they are all on admission. This gives us a total of about 56 that we were able to save and have been taken to hospital. So in all, you have like 31 now on admission, 24 treated and discharged, and then one referred to Kolebu. And for we're getting a figure of about 56, but our initial reaction with the people or the owners indicated that there were about 52 people having their morning devotion before they could start work as they do normally, and the building collapsed. So that the figures we are having from the hospitals now will still have to, our people are still on site and they are working. In fact, more bodies are being retrieved, but we will confirm those later for update.
But can you confirm the number of people who have died?
Not from me immediately, because it's only the hospital that can do that, because on site, as our people went around, they didn't hear any. On site, people were circulating numbers, but no one of us on site could determine whether somebody had died or not. So we are still going around and calling the hospitals. So we'll get to you with any further information on those.
Well, but how are you ensuring that the victims get continued support even after they have recovered from this shock or trauma?
Yes. What we normally do is that we give them the counseling, their families and themselves. The hospitals have those facilities. And so once they are there, well, what we do normally is we link up with the hospitals, and if there's any need to maybe give additional resources or find resources for their sustenance, we try to do that through our normal sources.
Well, earlier, NADMU called for assistance. I'm asking for floodlights. And have you received them?
Yes, we have received. We have some ourselves we have taken there. We received some from the USAID. And then there's a Korea construction company that have also sent some there. Our people on site have confirmed. If I left the site not just about when the lights were going to be put on. So I'm getting feedback from there.
Well, Eben, what would be your advice to people who construct such buildings?
Well, advice to them will also mean advice to the planning authorities. That is the Metro, Municipal and District Assembly. They have engineers there, they have site inspectors and all those people who approved of the buildings before the buildings take place, the planning. And the people themselves who build must make sure that they go through the normal system of the plan approval. And for the authorities, if I have more responsibility than those who even, people who are building, maybe they are commercial people, if the man was just building to rent for somebody and he just wants his money, he could do anything. So I think that the enforcement of the laws are more important. But there again, of course, those who build also lose their monies or resources. So it is good for them to also go through this. Maybe we may need to shorten some of the processes. Maybe some people go and they they think that the processes are long, and so they shortcut somewhere. So there are a whole lot of things we need to do. In fact, we, NADMO, we have been trying to bring back what we call the building code. We haven't really have had one that is working. So through the UNDP, we are in touch with the Ministry of Water Resources, Works and Housing, and they are coming out. In fact, they have finished with the thing we have with the code, and we will be bringing it out soon. But earlier, NADMO had come out using the same people, talking to or engaging people who do buildings in the various assemblies, the carpenters, the masons, the plumbers, all those artisans. We have met them several times, and with their own suggestions, they have come out with for build smaller buildings in most of the our local assemblies. That's why we call it building guide. We have had it printed with money assistance from the UNDP.
All right.
We have distributed to, we launched it. We invited some digital executives and some ministers. We have distributed some to the some of the digital assemblies so they could give to people who want to build and sell at some giveaway price.
All right.
Yeah.
Eben, it's been a pleasure talking to you tonight.
Thank you for talking to me too.
Ebenezer Dosu is the Deputy National Coordinator in charge of Technical Affairs. And almost all the political actors busily campaigning around the country have cut short their politicking to sympathize with the victims and survivors of the disaster. At the disaster scene today, where President John Mahama, Vice President Kwesi Mensah, and other high-profile government officials, NPP running mate Dr. Baumia and his party chairman Jacob Echebi Lamte, were also at the scene, including CPP's chairperson Samia Nkrumah. President Mahama expressed his condolences to the bereaved and asked that those found culpable after investigations be made to answer for their misdeeds. And we scheduled an interview with his spokesperson, John Jinapo, but we are currently having challenges with his line. It's Behind the News, live on Radio Ghana. It's Behind the News, live on Radio Ghana. Careers alive on Garden City, 92.1 in Kumasi, and in Sinyans on Radio BAR, 93.5, and in Tamale, it's Radio Savannah, 91.2. And let's read some of your text messages. We should call for the head of the contractor who put up the collapsed building. That's from Andrew's Roman Rage. The Malcolm tragedy should be a matter of concern to all Ghanaians. Let's pray for victims to receive the mercy of God. And that's Joe Banye Inwa. May Almighty Allah protect and save those still trapped in the rubble. And that's from A.U. Faruk. And Yawasakin Dane Taifa says, my heart bleeds whenever I see such a gargantuan tragedy. My condolences to all of them, and I wish those injured speedy recovery. Many thanks for your text messages. Now to our next story. It was billed to be a clash on economic issues. Well, if this was your guess, you were not far from right, as economic issues took the shine of the vice president debate in Takoradi yesterday. The two running mates, Dr. Mamadou Bawumia of the NPP and incumbent vice president Kwesi Mensah of the NDC, both economists among two women vice presidential candidates of the PNC and CPP, challenge each other over the records of their parties on the performance of various sectors of the nation's economy. Whereas the two economists were at home, for instance, with questions on the inflation rate and the depreciation of the cedi, the two other candidates could not help but passionately take the issues out of economic context and relate it to the standard of living of the Ghanaian. So the candidates on the day sound convincing with their performance in the day and the fortunes of the parties around. Joining us on the line is Dr. Lloyd Amau, is a policy analyst. You're welcome, Doc.
Thank you very much, madam. Happy to be on air.
Well, did the vice presidential debate live up to its billing?
Well, I think that what we had essentially was, in my judgment, somewhat a mixed outcome. Because, well, for the first segment where you had the economic issues brought center and forward, I mean, the two gentlemen, that is Dr. Baromia and then Vice President Emisa Atta, were definitely at home in that kind of terrain because that is their forte. And so they brought interesting perspectives on some of the major fundamental questions that ail our national economy. But I think that maybe the hyping was a bit problematic because this was not going to be simply about economics. It was going to be about economics and other issues. So maybe the way in which we construed and formulated, the kind of debate we were going to have in terms of it going to be generally and wholly, the economy based, can be said to be one of the problems. All in all, I think that, to the extent that these candidates, were made to think through issues that bordered not just on the economy, but also on social questions and broader questions about regionalism, West Africa, and the rest of them, made it useful in the long run.
But how would you mark the performance of the candidates on the night?
Well, I don't think that this particular debate is about grading per se, because it's a bit complicated. But voters will make up their minds in terms of the posture of these individuals, their capacity to think on their feet, the way in which they performed in different areas. I would give the economy aspect to, I think that Dr. Bouamwa presented a very intellectualized, response to the policy questions on the economy. And then Vice President also provided us with some, if you like, practical, direct policy experience, responses. So the two of them, actually for me presented fairly useful positions on the economy. But when it comes to social issues, I think that the two gentlemen found it a bit, difficult to convince me. And so I thought that the CPP lady, Kuma, did particularly well when it came to social issues. Obviously, it was clear that she had dealt with the issues. These were issues that were on her heart. She had pondered about them, thought about them. And so that is how I would do the rating. I mean, I'll do it on a segment basis. And then ultimately, I think Ghanaians would have to decide themselves, who for them fits the bill as a useful vice presidential, candidate.
But will their performance in any way have an impact in the fortunes of their parties?
Well, I think that, these debates are tricky. If you make a mistake, a grievous mistake, then that can have some bearing on the way in which people would cast their votes. At this particular point in time in the election, most people have made up their mind more or less. But you see, elections are always tricky. And in our elections, I think that you have a certain segment of people who remain undecided. We tended to call them floating. So they will make up their minds as we go along. Some people would even change their minds when they get to the ballot box, So, we cannot discount these debates as not ultimately important in terms of influencing the minds of voters. It will have some impact. Question is, to what extent? But I think that in the long run, people would watch these debates and to some extent be influenced by it in terms of the kind of people who we want to lead our republic to the kind of level that we all see, and very quickly.
Well, Doc, but would you describe it as a debate? Because some argue that it's more of a question and answer thing.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's the participants who would have to make it a debate. Because, for example, you have three chances to make a rebuttal.
Yeah.
So when a point is made by your colleague, a skilled debater, a skilled public orator, should be able to provide a counterpoint to a position that is taken. And that is what makes it a debate. But if you have individuals in there who do not necessarily want to be combative, then it reduces the intensity of the interaction. But it is still a debate because the candidates in questions who are lined up are providing perspectives on national policy. And we know that the parties have different approaches to how it is that we intend to deal with our national, you know, policy problems. So within that context, even though you call it a question and answer, you know, because the moderators ask questions and the candidates respond, it is still a debate, you know, through and through, I mean, without a doubt. Question is whether or not it is crisp, it is fiery, it is intense. But I think that at moments we have flashes of this coming up, which I think we saw, for example, in the last debate.
Should these platforms be encouraged then?
Well, I think so. You know, it's important for our republic that we continue to engage in deep cerebral interactions on the questions that ail us. I mean, for example, in this particular debate, one matter that came up was the issue of sanitation. Obviously, we are facing very, very deep questions about sanitation that even border on the dignity of us as a people and as a republic. And I mean, obviously, the narratives that came out of it were a bit problematic in terms of what it is that the candidates said, almost indicating that the problems with sanitation are the result of we Ghanaian citizens being sloven and dirty. But the questions are far more deeper. There's a supply side question as well in terms of open drainage system. We don't punish people when they litter. People do not, you know, have, like, you know, toilets in their homes. These are the questions, you know. So, I mean, once such a debate came up, we have an idea of the kind of thinking that our political elites have on such questions. Then, if they are wrong, we can correct them in the public sphere and then reconstruct, reorganize, rejig the kind of narratives that affect our lives in terms of policy. So I think these platforms ought to be encouraged, and we as citizens should actively participate in them and hold those who put themselves forward to run this republic to strict tenets of proof, so that they think through the questions, and when we give them power, go and execute on behalf of us, the people of this republic.
Well, Doc, you are a policy analyst, and you have been listening and monitoring the statements and campaigns of these parties and their candidates. Would you say they are properly addressing the policy issues that they have been talking about and for which they are seeking the people's mandate? You talk about housing, education, health, and what have you.
I think that in these elections, what has happened is that some key policy questions have been thrown out and have been made the key points around which almost all the political parties seem to be pivoting around. And so education has been brought to the fore. This has become a key question which the other parties, brought forward by the New Patriotic Party, and then the ruling government has been also, in a sense, been made to more or less present its position on education. And then we have the economy, unemployment. You know, when you take the NDP, for example, it is talking about dealing with unemployment by industrializing our republic. When you take the NDC, it has a perspective in terms of dealing with young people and their skills, the National Youth Employment Program, and that sort of thing. To a very large extent, we have a laundry list of issues. All the parties, or at least the key parties, seem to have an approach to how it is that they want to deal with a problem.
Right.
I think that in the long run, we have to judge what it is that they are saying in terms of how they think they can solve the problem. And then ultimately, I think when we are convinced by the arguments that they prefer, and then we vote for either X or Y, then how it is that when they have power, they go about it becomes a key issue. Because we should not forget that policy actually is said that sometimes it is when you confront reality, you know, that policy begins to take form and begins to shape up. But at the level of ideas, you know, it's always a tricky thing. You know, it's always a tricky thing at the level of ideas.
Well, briefly, before...
when you're out of government, it's always tricky. maybe you do not have all the facts, etc., etc. And of course, when you have power, it's about navigating the realities of both your policy context and the reality of the general international policy environment. You know, so by and large, I think that the key issues that have been brought forward are important. Education, I think, is key because it is on the level of the education of the masses of our people that our nation will possibly make those important strides.
But, Doug, briefly, Doug, let me cut in here. One missing jigsaw in all these debates or platform is the question of security. So far, we have not heard much about security. Would you say security is being relegated to the background briefly?
Yes. Security in terms of, is it the election security or national security?
Yeah, national security.
Well, I think that by and large, Ghana is not in a state of war. By and large, we are accepting that democracy is the only game in town. By and large, I think that we have some institutional framework for dealing with possible tensions amongst the parties. And so I think that there's a certain sense of confidence about how it is that we want to go about the elections. And so confidence about the elections and security surrounding it.
All right.
Broadly, security, the security of our state. I think that generally there is some level of agreement that we ought to go through this process with a fair degree of equanimity and level-headedness.
All right, Doc, we have to end it here, Doc. It's a pleasure having you on our program.
Okay, that's okay. Best wishes.
Dr. Lloyd Ama is a policy analyst. He's behind the news live on Radio Ghana, Accra. Americans have given their verdict on who should occupy the White House for the next 4 years. Incumbent President Barack Obama and Republican challenger Mitt Romney fought a fierce campaign to seek the mandate of U.S. voters to steer the affairs of the country. And when it was all over in the early hours of today, Americans renewed the mandate of Mr. Obama. On the eve of the elections, we saw the views of a research fellow at the Legon Center for International Affairs and Diplomacy, Dr. Ken Ahosu, was upbeat about President Obama sailing through, adding, though, that it may not be an easy task. We are again fortunate tonight to have Dr. Ahosu to tell us what should be the focus of Mr. Obama, given the apparent divisive campaign just before the polls. You're welcome, sir.
Good evening.
Good evening. Now, has the outcome of the U.S. election offered any surprises?
Not really. It was expected to be tight. I think the only surprise is Indiana, which has gone from blue to red. So there is not much surprise, but I think at the end of the day, it was an easy win, kind of, for President Obama.
Well, President Obama constitutionally cannot contest after next 4 years. Can that make him take things for granted?
No, not at all. The difficulty that he faced in the second election shows that in order to leave a landmark or to leave a good name in American politics, he has to really work and solve the issues that have been raised or criticisms that have been raised against him, particularly the economy. That was the main concern of Americans, and that is why a lot of people toyed with going Romney. So, as he himself said, he's going to consult Romney and his team and see how best they can fix the economy. So, this is a time that he has to work very hard. And again, issues like the medical insurance issue, Obamacare, that he promised, must try to work in a bipartisan manner as to how these policies are put across to the Americans.
Well, Doc, what should be his priorities now when it comes to Africa and other developing countries?
I don't think Obama is the kind of person who is going to have a kind of Obama-African policy, a kind of grandiose policy. What will be the main concern now is the security on African continent, particularly the Mali issue that is on the hands of ECOWAS, the Al-Shabaab that is on the hands of AU, and the spread of Al-Qaeda to Africa, because these are the very reasons that Africa is becoming a strategic reason, a region, in the sense that there is a lot of oil that America is turning to. So I think security issues are issues that he has to deal with. As concerning trade, I think the initiative should come from both Africans and then the Obama administration. It is not going to be like George Bush Jr. who comes and then have a policy in hand and ask Africans to follow that kind of policy.
Well, the Republicans have to go back to the drawing board to re-strategize. What lessons are there for them after losing again to the Democrats?
From my analysis, it's becoming clear that the Republicans will continue to be in for some time and probably for a long time to come. Because if you look at the demography of America, things are changing. Younger people, the population is there. Younger people are increasing. And then the Hispanic voters are also increasing. And these are people that the Republicans do not integrate into their system. They are very conservative, and they are more concerned with the upper class and then the rich in society. So they do not appeal to the young. They do not appeal to migrants. And the migrants are increasing in number. And the projection is that in about 10 years, the Latin American migrants are going to be in the majority. So if things continue the way they are, then it is almost obvious that the Republicans will stay in opposition for a long time. I think what they need probably is a young leader, someone who has charisma and can appeal to both migrants and then the conservative Americans. But until they have that, then it's not possible. They will continue to be in the opposition.
Well, Doc, is there anything Ghanaians can learn from their U.S. counterparts in the way the elections went and the early declaration of results, including graceful concession from Governor Romney?
Yeah, I think this time around in Ghana, elections will be declared earlier than it used to be, simply because of the biometric registration. And everything is in line. Once you vote, it comes to a central point. So it's easier to declare the winner and the loser. As for the conceding of elections, whether the loser will concede, that depends solely on the loser. The point is that if the loser felt that he has been rough-shouldered or there is some form of acrimony, then that loser may delay in conceding. But if the leader feels that he has lost on fair ground, then he may come out early and say that I'm sorry, but that's it depends purely on the idiosyncrasies of the leader that is losing, and that one we cannot do anything about it.
Well, we have to thank you very much for your time with us tonight, Doc.
Thank you.
Dr. Ken Ahosu is a research fellow at the Lagos Center for International Affairs and Diplomacy. And before we leave, let's read some of your text messages. U.S. Obama in, Mitt Romney out, Ghana's John Mahama in, Nanado out. That's from Kojo, Accra Central. What is wrong with the GTV transmission? On and off, always. We deserve better. That's from Sewa. Your concerns will be addressed. The NPP and Nanado will triumph over the others by gargantuan gap. That's from Bruce Inwa. And this text from Akwesi Tumu says, now when people go to Melcom, they'll have to stand outside and scream for the things they will buy. But we hope that this should not be the case, because Melcom has been a good servant to Ghanaians. Akwesi, don't worry. Thank you very much for all your texts and messages. And this is where we wrap up for tonight's edition of Behind the News. Edmond Tete, Brian Tagama, Christopher Sidi, Kinsley Robinson, John Poby were my producers. And George Kwaku controlled the sounds. And George Asikri was my summarizer. My name is Agatha Samwa. You have a lovely night.